In eastern Ukraine, the battle for Bakhmut grows more intense, with no end in sight.
Right now, it's been turned to rubble, turned to ruins by the Russians, and they're still unable to take control of it. Every second day, they say we're almost in full control, but then they disprove themselves.
Also today, Japan says its people are now free to take off their COVID masks indoors. Many, though, are just not ready. This young woman says when she's wearing a mask, she feels a sense of freedom. She also says it's easier to deal with makeup. And in South Africa, they're losing power for up to 9 hours a day. Consider what that's like for restaurants. Refrigerators go down and...
You lose customers because of sometimes when they come in, there is no gas as a backup, so we lose money.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to be with you. 20 years ago this month, the U.S. military led an invasion to topple Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. That was the easy part. Early on, the justification for going to war was to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. No WMDs were ever found. For years after the invasion, U.S. officials spoke a lot about fighting terrorism and building a democratic Iraq. Now, 20 years later, the consequences of the Iraq War are still being felt. In the coming days, we're going to be hearing from Iraqis about the legacy of the war and their hopes for the future. The World's Shirin Jafari is in Iraq, where this week she met with an Iraqi journalist who, back in 2008, suddenly found himself the center of global news media attention.
On the outskirts of Iraq's capital, Baghdad, the streets don't have names, trash is not collected, and the roads are full of potholes. Here, in an unassuming brick house, is where 48-year-old Montazer Al-Zaidi lives with his wife and daughter.
Shirin.
Nice to meet you.
He greets me and my interpreter at the edge of a small garden that separates the dusty road from his home. Zaidi stepped into the global spotlight 15 years ago. On December 14, 2008, he hurled his shoes at the President of the United States. At a press conference in Baghdad, a younger Zaidi stands up and throws one shoe at President George W. Bush. Then he picks up his other one and throws that one too. Bush looks stunned. It takes those around him a few seconds to react. In this single moment, the relatively unknown Iraqi journalist became the face of resistance to some and a troublemaker to others. Zaidi was arrested. He spent 9 months in prison and says he was tortured by Iraqi security forces. In recent years, Zaidi says he's had a hard time finding work as a journalist because news outlets don't want to be seen as anti-American. But he explains that he doesn't have any regrets about what he did that day. He says the West didn't know about all the atrocities that were taking place in Iraq at the time. As a reporter, he says he was covering stories about U.S. military raids and sectarian violence. He says there was a perception in the West that Saddam Hussein was gone and that Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds were living peacefully in a democracy. Zaidi describes throwing his shoes as sort of a scream, an attempt to draw the world's attention to the suffering in his country. To say no, Iraqis didn't all welcome Americans with roses. Zaidi tells me about going to the press conference all those years ago. He says he picked his dirtiest, oldest shoes, as if to add to the insult. He went in expecting he might get killed. He chose his seat carefully, picking one in the last row, so if he got shot, no one behind him would be hit. I asked Zaidi if his views have shifted over the years. My interpreter, Alaa Muhammad, translates.
How can I forgive these people who have done these atrocities against my brother, my neighbor, my father, and they haven't at least apologized, nor they went into trial, and they are still free at large.
Zaidi tells me that he's got no ill feelings toward the American public. But Iraq, he says, has gone from bad to worse. When Montazer Al-Zaidi thinks about the legacy of the U.S. invasion that began two decades ago, He says Iraqis are still paying a heavy price. Our politicians are being manipulated by neighboring countries, he says. Iran is essentially running the government here. And who's to blame, I ask?
America. George W. Bush. نفوذ الإيراني في العراق من مخلفات أمريكا.
For the world, Shirin Jafari, Baghdad, Iraq.
When Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed to revive diplomatic relations last week, it sent ripples across the Middle East. No country is paying closer attention to the impacts than Israel. Israel's security strategy has long included having Saudi Arabia as a heat shield to Iran, but the recent diplomatic shifts could threaten that. Joining me to discuss this is Aaron David Miller. He's a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former analyst with the U.S. State Department. He joins us from Washington. Aaron, do you think the Israelis have something to be nervous about following this rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
The notion that somehow Saudi Arabia would allow itself to be enlisted as the tip of a U.S. or an Israeli spear against Iran was a strategy that was more or less untethered, I think, from reality. The Saudis understand the limitations of an American security guarantee. They're hedging. They're sending a signal, I think, to the administration that, in essence, the Middle East has now become a multipolar market.
Well, let's look at what we do know. For Israel, how important is Saudi Arabia as this defensive barrier against Iran?
Like an iceberg with a quarter of the mass above the waterline, most of what the Saudis and the Israelis are doing together is below the waterline. I think there's a very robust security and intelligence set of relationships there. But I don't think the Israelis ever banked on the notion that they would be able to, you know, fly operations out of Saudi Arabia against Iran or any other Arab country.
I mean, for Israel in this multipolar world in the Mideast, as you put it, I mean, that's driven in part by the Abraham Accords. There's also this dividend of normalizing, as you say, relations with Saudi Arabia. But does the deal or rapprochement, whatever we want to call it, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, does that put that kind of diplomacy at risk?
So the real question, I think, is in terms of Israeli-Saudi normalization, who's going to put that package together? Clearly, the Saudis have made it known, at least informally, what they want from the United States to create a pathway to normalization with Israel. One would be security guarantees. A second, I'm sure, would be the reopening or the absence of congressional restraints against Saudi arms sales. And they want U.S. help with creating a civilian nuclear program.
Yeah, I mean, you just went down a list of things, which is a pretty healthy punch list from the point of view of the U.S.
It is, and I think that's why I think it's going to be problematic. I saw one report yesterday in which the Israelis claimed they were aware of this reconciliation. I think in that respect, this comes as a blow. I mean, after all, the current Israeli prime minister had three priorities when he came into office: Iran, Iran, and Iran. And I'd also note this morning that the Saudis, having agreed initially to allow the Israeli foreign minister to attend a UN conference on tourism in Saudi Arabia, so had agreed in principle, but when it came time to discuss the security needs and requirements, the Saudis weren't prepared to do that. It may, in fact, be the first indication that this recent rapprochement with Iran may well force the Saudis to at least suspend for the time being any further evidence that they're prepared to get closer to the Israelis.
I mean, you make a good point earlier. I mean, Israel's rhetoric around Iran, especially under Netanyahu, has always been existential. Doesn't Israel want that tension with Iran to go away? I mean, maybe Israel wouldn't talk to Tehran directly, but does this open the possibility that Israel might have at least a back channel in Saudi Arabia?
I think it's going to be very difficult to triangulate, at least now, any sort of back channel contacts between Iran and Israel vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. It is an interesting possibility, though, and it should be tucked away and not forgotten.
It is notable that China facilitated this deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. How should the United States feel about that?
Think about it from the administration's perspective. You have America's erstwhile international adversary, and U.S.-Chinese relations are about as low as they've been in decades. Cutting a deal with a presumptive American ally and America's erstwhile adversary in the region. I think the administration is probably correct in assuming that Iranian-Saudi hostility will prevent a full-fledged transformation in their relationship. But they have to be, I think, somewhat annoyed by the fact that the whole notion of using Saudi Arabia to deter Iran or their own policies of trying to isolate and pressure Iran in the region has received a serious setback. You've got the most important Arab state with respect to its Islamic credibility and legitimacy entering into full diplomatic relations with what Washington looks at as a pariah, Iran.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joined us from Washington. Aaron, thank you.
Marco, thank you.
In Japan, a COVID milestone, masks are no longer required for indoor spaces like restaurants or shopping malls, nor on public transportation and airplanes. Outdoor mask rules were eased earlier this year in Japan. Now, in many places around the globe, it's been a struggle to get people to put masks on. In Japan, though, the government has been struggling to get people to take off their masks. Masks in Japan have been described as a second skin. To find out how people are reacting about the end of indoor protection, reporter Tsanka Siripala visited Shibuya, the lively entertainment district in Tokyo, a place that's popular with many young people.
Okay, my name is Nodoka. I'm a university student.
Why are you wearing a mask today?
Firstly, the company told us to wear a mask, so I have my mask on today. And then, for a second, I have like an allergy, so I had to wear one. And then, thirdly, I kind of had this feeling that I still had to see people how they do, and then
watch check
them.
What everyone
yes,
is.
Yes, yes, and then. Yeah, make my mind or something.
Do you like wearing a mask?
I'm fine with this.
Who, me?
I never ever wear a mask. Actually, I don't wear one, well, because today the mask rule ends and because it's hard to breathe.
I sell cars for a living. I had a customer meeting, so I put on a mask. Now, if the customer isn't wearing one, I don't wear one. But at my shop, the rule is to wear one if the customer is. I absolutely do not want to wear one. They always slide down my face, and I always lose them. As far as I'm concerned, masks are gishiki, and gishiki means ceremonial or just for show.
Yes, I do feel a sense of freedom. It's so much easier, especially for doing my makeup.
My name is Kai. I'm a freelance video editor in Tokyo.
I see you're not wearing a mask. Why?
Yes. I didn't mind wearing it. It's less comfortable than not having it. I think it's about time. I see people starting to do it as well, but I think it's just not something that'll change until more people start to do it. I mean, even before the pandemic, it was already part of Japanese culture. If anyone was sick, you know, you'd wear it on public transportation. I think that was very considerate of the people around you. Of course, there's the whole thing about mask usagi. People have said the ikemen, the handsome people in Tokyo, have risen because of masks. Like, they say that because you can't see their nose or their mouth, you can only see their eyes, that, you know, there's a lot more beautiful people in Tokyo these days. Like, I can't remember what, like, people without masks, like, smiling look like.
Reporter Tsanka Siripala in Tokyo's Shibuya district, speaking there with the following young people: Kai, Mayu Yoshida, Hajime Imoto, Taka Yamashita, and Nadoko. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The typical American might experience a few hours without electricity each year. Most blackouts are because of major weather events. South Africans, they've been in the dark for several hours a day for months. The government recently declared a state of disaster. Last week, the country's first minister of electricity was sworn in, but the task ahead will be long and complicated. From Johannesburg, Elna Schutz explains what life is like in the meantime.
As an audio reporter, I try to have a very quiet working environment. Not anymore. That's my backup inverter, powering my Wi-Fi, and an old bedside table lamp. Here's my gas stovetop, though I'd normally use an electric kettle. And then, of course, there's the neighbourhood generators running on petrol. But I'm one of the lucky few who can afford a full setup like this for planned power outages. These rolling blackouts are called load shedding here. And it's become an increasingly bothersome fact of life in South Africa over the last 4 years or so. This means that according to the stage of rationing that the country is in, your power is switched off according to an area-based schedule. For instance, at stage 6, 6,000 megawatts are taken from the national grid, meaning lights out for around 9 hours a day. Load shedding was implemented for 43% of last year. If that sounds like a crisis to you, President Cyril Ramaphosa agrees.
We are therefore declaring a national state of disaster to respond to the electricity crisis and its effect.
This gives the government broader powers for the crisis, like exempting critical infrastructure from load shedding. It lets new electricity producers skip through environmental regulations and unlocks extra finances. But everyone is feeling the pressure.
Load shedding, it affects us very badly.
This is Fana Kumalo, who runs a number of businesses in Orlando East, a part of South Africa's biggest township, Soweto. One of them is the Monster Project Kitchen, which is tucked off of a busy road, serving food to up to 100 people a day.
Because with traditional food, you need to prepare it in the morning because of you have to cook it for long hours.
The main dish today is cow heart, with the stiff staple maize porridge pap, usually shared and eaten by hand.
Pap and mohodu, pap and heart, pap and liver, and pap and cow head. So, yeah, that's what we do. We cook here. We serve our people. We have a sit-in. You can come and just buy and eat, or you can do a takeaway. Yes.
Normally, there's music in the background and lots of people around. But since the power just went out, they're cooking on gas stoves to the sound of their neighbor's generator. Kumalo says they have become used to working on a schedule and will get by, but it's been hard.
We had to lose staff. We had to release, I think, 3 ladies due to we can't pay them well. So we are doing things for ourselves now. You lose customers because of sometimes when they come in, there is no gas as a backup. So we lose money in that way. And the food also, we eat it. What can we do? Or we give it to the orphans here in our neighborhood, or we share with our friends.
He feels government is failing ordinary South Africans and small businesses. Of course, these problems didn't happen overnight. Since 2017, there have been increasing bouts of load shedding for a few months at a time, often because of compromised or failing infrastructure. Independent energy analyst Clyde Mallinson says that a few decades ago, the country had a surplus of coal-powered electricity based in part on apartheid-era sanctions.
So we really, really are in big trouble at the moment. We've run out of time.
The coal infrastructure is now out of date, and new energy sources are not ready to take over. Mallinson says there's a looming electricity inequality ahead.
The economic engine of the country is in small to medium-sized business operations in all of the towns and cities. And it's those that are bleeding at the moment by virtue of not being able to have electricity or have money to back up.
The government's current energy action plan includes new renewable energy, more imported power, and improved existing power plants. The different scenarios place the end of load shedding anywhere between a few months to a few years.
And then in a sense, the rest of the population having to pick up the load of very expensive, very dirty electricity coming from a gasping, dying utility.
For now, load shedding continues, and with it, the resilience of South Africans to adapt. For The World, I'm Erna Schütz in Johannesburg.
For British sports fans, the music and the voice are familiar.
Here we go again. New season, new titles, new managers, new signings.
It's Match of the Day with commentator Gary Lineker. The former soccer player is the most highly paid BBC personality. His fans number in the millions. That's the background. Hold on to it.
Our asylum system has been overwhelmed. We're now spending almost 7 million.
This is Britain's Home Secretary Suella Braverman announcing the UK's new policy to control migration. The new program is nicknamed Stop the Boats. That's in reference to the small boats migrants have used to cross the English Channel to seek asylum in the UK.
It's not fair that people who travel through a string of safe countries and then come to the UK illegally can jump the queue and game our system. This bill will bring an end to that. Enough is enough. We must stop the boats.
Gary Lineker found the language offensive, and he said so in a tweet. He called it an immeasurably cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable people. He compared the government's new immigration plan to 1930s Germany. That tweet got close to 100,000 likes and a lot of backlash. Pressure grew from the conservative press for the BBC to discipline Gary Lineker for being too political, unprofessional. On Friday, Lineker's friend and journalist Dan Walker went on air at rival broadcaster Channel 5. He read from a text conversation he was having with Lineker.
There's one word in there I can't use, but he has said, no, they've told me I have to step back.
In a show of solidarity, Lineker's Match of the Day colleagues said they too would step back. So Saturday comes and some 2.5 million viewers tune in to watch Match of the Day. But the show was not there. No theme, no Gary Lineker, no words even. Just this. A 20-minute highlight reel of the day's games with absolutely no commentary. Viewers called it bizarre. Then Prime Minister Rishi Sunak weighed in. In a statement, he said he hopes the situation could be quickly resolved. But that, it's a matter for the BBC, not the British government. Today, the BBC announced that it has ended Lineker's suspension. The presenter has agreed to stick to current editorial guidelines until a new policy is formed, defusing a free speech controversy that dominated the news for an entire week. One thing that got overshadowed in all the shouting, Britain's troubled migration policy. You're with the world. Before Bad Bunny, before Shakira, before Ricky Martin, there was Gloria Estefan. The Cuban-American artist became a pioneer of Latin music.
They kept telling us, no, you're too Latin for the Americans, you're too American for the Latins, radio won't play this.
Gloria Estefan and the Havana-Miami connection, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, this is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For months now, the fighting in and around Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine has been brutal and relentless. It's been especially deadly this past week, according to Ukraine's president.
За час із 6 березня і лише на одному бахмутському напрямку вдалося знищити.
Last night, Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine has killed more than 1,100 Russian soldiers near Bakhmut. The fighting in and around the city has been costly for the Ukrainians, too. The World's Daniel Hoffman has more on the battle for Bakhmut and what comes next.
Over the winter, the front lines in this war have not shifted much at all.
On the battlefield, there is currently a grinding attritional war in which neither side has a definitive military advantage.
That's Avril Haines, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, speaking last week before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
The Russians are making incremental progress on Bakhmut, which is not a particularly strategic objective, but are otherwise facing considerable constraints.
Haines says those constraints on the Russian side include personnel and ammunition shortages, exhaustion, and problems with morale. But for both sides, Bakhmut has taken on symbolic significance.
Overall, Ukraine's objective has always been unchanged. We need to liberate our lands.
Yuri Sak is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defense. He says Bakhmut, even before the war, was a small city.
The population of the city was about 70,000 people. Now, that's not a big city, okay? Right now, it's been turned to rubble, turned to ruins by the Russians, and they're still unable to take control of it. Every second day, they say we're almost in full control, but then they disprove themselves.
Both sides have lost a lot of personnel and equipment in Bakhmut over the last several weeks. But Sak says bogging down Russian troops there may help Ukraine in the long run.
Our approach is maximizing the losses of the enemy while minimizing our own losses and getting ourselves time for the preparation of our own counteroffensive.
Some military experts question the value of holding on to Bakhmut given the cost, but Sak says this one city is not the ultimate goal for Ukraine.
Our general staff, our military command is making plans, and as soon as we have the sufficient capabilities which we are receiving from our allies, we will be ready to strike back. And one thing which has not been kept secret is that this spring will be a very decisive moment for the future of this war.
When Yuri Sak says capabilities, he's referring to advanced weapons promised to Ukraine by Western countries. That includes tanks, artillery systems, and more ammunition. Some of that equipment is starting to arrive in Ukraine now, just as Russia is struggling to supply its own forces. Pavel Luzin is a visiting scholar at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
The Russian armed forces has changed a lot because Russia lost its professional ground army. Ground army means ground troops together with airborne troops and together with Marines.
After heavy losses, Luzin says Russia's military force is now mostly made up of reservists and newly mobilized troops.
Russia lost the most trained and the most combat-ready manpower, and Russia lost a significant part of the most advanced weapons. Main battle tanks, armored vehicles, artillery, combat helicopters, and combat aircrafts.
Luzin says Russia has also burned through a lot of its long-range missiles, and its production capacity can't keep up. Nora Ben-Sahel at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies says the Biden administration's support for Ukraine has been steady, but that could change.
The big split in the United States now is not between the Department of Defense and the intelligence community or the president and Congress, really. It's between the two political parties.
Ben-Sahel says the consensus in Washington for supporting Ukraine's military has wavered over the last few months.
The Ukrainians have done tremendously well with the amount of weapons that they have received with all of that support. So I think the biggest threat to the Ukrainian ability to advance over the summer, of course, it's the Russian military. But in second place next to that is if the U.S. starts spending less money to provide that kind of critical support.
In other words, time is of the essence for the Ukrainians as they prepare for a counteroffensive. The Kremlin appears to be working from a different timeline. Here's Avril Haines again, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence.
Putin most likely calculates that time works in his favor and that prolonging the war, including with potential pauses in the fighting, may be his best remaining pathway to eventually securing Russia's strategic interests in Ukraine, even if it takes years.
And years of war is something Ukraine desperately wants to avoid. Defense advisor Yuri Sak put it this way.
Nobody should be interested in allowing it to drag out beyond 2023. We have to win this year, and it's possible.
For the World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
For more of our ongoing coverage of the war in Ukraine and what life is like there today, go to our website, theworld.org. You'll find stories about how life goes on for ordinary Ukrainians, like Ukrainian athletes continuing to compete on the international stage, even with their country at war. Let's take a big turn now from that war in Europe to a cultural icon here in the Americas. I'm just going to keep on counting till you are mine. The words and sounds of Gloria Estefan. The Cuban-American singer-songwriter is headed into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in June, the first Hispanic woman to be inducted. She is a pioneer of Latin music and has opened the door for other Latin artists who found their place in the U.S. music scene, like Jennifer Lopez, Shakira, Ricky Martin. Joining us from her home in Miami is Gloria Estefan. What a pleasure to have you with us. Very good to meet you.
It's a pleasure for me and a thrill to be speaking to everyone that's listening out there.
So as I said, later this spring, you'll be entering into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. You've won already multiple Grammys, a Kennedy Center honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now you're being recognized as a songwriter, the first Hispanic woman inducted, as I said. What does this particular honor mean for you?
I have to say that it is one of the most special honors because music has been an incredibly healing force. So I remember sitting as a child with the albums and the liner notes, reading every lyric, listening to every word. And a lot of those incredible artists, Carole King, Stevie Wonder, Elton John, the Beatles, they spoke to me. Never would I have imagined or dreamed at that time that one day the words and the music that I would write would do the same for other people.
As to that fact, you're being the first Hispanic woman to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Should that surprise us? I mean, what do you think took so long?
You know, it doesn't surprise me because if you really look at how long the awards have been around and the fact that every year they choose five or six people and there are so many incredible artists, it, you know, it's tough. It's a tough choice to make. And I'm just thankful that it happened. I think that everything takes a minute. And sometimes there were a lot of Hispanic people back in the day that were in movies and even actresses that had to change their name in order to work. So there may have been other Hispanics out there doing things that people didn't know were Hispanics.
I mean, as to your own kind of oeuvre, you've written so many songs. Five have gone to number one on the charts, gold records, platinum and multi-platinum records. Does songwriting come easy to you? I mean, do you ever get like songwriter's block?
You know what? I haven't gotten blocked because it hasn't been to the point where I've had the pressure to have to write. But every time I write one, I think, I'll never be able to do this again. It's kind of like when you give birth. Any woman that has given birth, the last thing on her mind right after she's given birth to that baby is, oh, I'm going to do this again as soon as possible.
The second you came on the scene, it seemed, your songs and music brought really an important shift in the music industry. Your music took Latin idioms, including the 3-2 clave beat, and fuse it to kind of high-energy 80s production values in a way that Americans had not really heard, songs like Conga.
Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer. Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga. No, you can't control yourself any longer.
How difficult was that crossover, musically speaking?
It was tough. When I joined the band, Emilio asked...
Your husband.
Emilio, yes. He was my boss at the time. We weren't even dating. When I joined the band, they only did Latin music. And when I joined, I brought the influence of dance music and pop and ballads. We did our first two albums completely bilingual, half in English and half in Spanish. So when Sony came to sign us, they wanted us to record all in Spanish. But I told them, look, our albums are bilingual. We fully intend one day to record in English. We want the contractual right to be able to do so. And then we snuck Dr. Beat onto our fourth Spanish language album. We put it on the B-side of the single, sent it to the clubs, and then all of a sudden we were number one in Europe. So it's not as if we were trying, let me cross over, but we were doing what we intended to do, which was be bilingual. Now, radio, that was a tough nut to crack because they kept telling us, no, you're too Latin for the Americans, you're too American for the Latins. Radio won't play this. And it was actually a guy who was an independent promoter at the time, had a friend in St. Louis, and he begged him to give it a shot and just play conga one time. And the guy did, and the phones went crazy. And it took a full year for conga to get into the top 10. But yeah, it was tough to convince.
De mi tierra bella, de mi tierra santa.
So, Mi Tierra, was that the first album in Spanish that went to the international market?
It was the first album in Spanish that was worldwide.
Mm.
It was a big chance as well. We were at the peak of our pop career. You know, we were on a sold-out world tour, and then we tell them, by the way, the next album we want to do is all in Spanish. They thought we were crazy. And what I told them was, we have an audience out there. We trust that they're going to want to know where our influences come from that allowed us to do this hybrid, because we completely understood the Latin rhythms because we played those. And we also understood the dance beat, the funk bass line. It was natural for us. And I think Miami growing up here had a lot to do with that.
Today, people don't bat an eye like when Bad Bunny records an album all in Spanish. But What did that album, Mitiera, represent for you back then? A vindication of sorts?
It represented so much more than that. We had to leave our homeland behind, and the musicians that were left in Cuba were severely restricted by what they could write or record and have played on Cuban radio. If you weren't towing the Castro line, they were frozen. The musicians that left, like Celia Cruz, the minute they left Cuba, they were erased from the musical history books purposely, so no one would know who they were. They didn't acknowledge that I was Cuban, even with all the success. So to us, it was a celebration of Cuban music. It was crucial to say, we may have left our homeland, but our homeland has never left us.
I'm speaking with Cuban-American artist and musician Gloria Estefan.
Qué alegría, sí, señor. Aquí con toda mi gente.
You and your family left the island for Miami in the 1960s. How was Miami then as a city and as a hub for Latin America and its culture? And how's it changed?
Oh, my gosh, so much it's changed. I still remember looking for a place to live with my mother and signs saying no children, no pets, no Cubans. We were in the deep South, and Miami was pretty much a place where people would come on vacation, and there was a lot of worry about the exiles that were coming and the vast numbers of them that were coming. So the people that were competing for jobs were not too open to this sudden influx of Cubans. No one spoke Spanish at that time. And it's a testament to the incredible Cuban community, the professionals that left Cuba, the doctors and lawyers that would come and work at whatever job they could find. And they really were a big part of building the city into what it is. Now, of course, there's way more than just Cubans here. We have a big influence from Central and South America, Brazil, Haiti. It really is a multicultural community. But when we came here, it certainly was not that.
So you and your family are tied to the politics of Cuba. Your father was a political prisoner in Cuba after he took part in the unsuccessful Bay of Pigs invasion, that attempt to overthrow the Castro government. How is he present in the songs that you've written?
My father is ever present in my songs like Oye Mi Canto, which speaks of freedom of speech.
Libre!
Freedom is a big subject matter to me in subtle and not so subtle ways. I really feel and defend the freedoms that we have in this country because we lost ours. My dad, as you mentioned, 2 years political prisoner in Cuba. Then he went to Vietnam, serving in the U.S. Army, and came back with Agent Orange poisoning and died at age 47, very young. But not so much the politics of Cuba as the social nature of freedom and being able to choose, that is very strongly instilled because of my father.
Despite the political differences across the Florida Strait, people are people, and I think there's a lot of pain on both sides. I'm curious to know how you see the future of U.S.-Cuban relations. How would you describe them today, and what would you like them to be?
Well, I think big changes have to happen in Cuba before we even start to think about what the U.S., their involvement could be. Nothing they've done has moved the needle one iota there. They have been able to buy from multiple countries, and still the people of Cuba are starving. They have many, many countries that have engaged in business there, you know, the French, the Italians, the Spaniards that have a lot of hotels there. And still the people of Cuba are paid a wage equivalent to $23 a month. They are oppressed. There are children in jail that are 16 and 17 years old that were jailed for coming out into the street just saying, I want freedom. There's humanitarian aid that goes there and doesn't get to the people. So there's really not much anyone could do. The people of Cuba need to be free.
You say, I know, it's a waste of time.
Moving off politics and back to the music, given that you're going to be inducted later this spring into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, I'm really curious to know how your songs are appreciated in Havana, the land you were born in.
Well, from what I hear, they play them now. I met in Spain once a DJ that had been beat up for playing my songs in Cuba on his show. This was back in the 80s. But from people that have gone there, they now play my songs at the hotels, but they don't say that it's me. They don't announce me on the radio or anything of that nature. But absolutely, the people of Cuba know who I am because I hear it when they come here to the United States and they tell me.
Music is a universal language, well, I sang more than it seems. Gloria Estefan will be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame at a ceremony on June 15th in New York City. Gloria, it was terrific to meet you. Thank you so much for the conversation, and congratulations on the honor.
Thank you so much, Marco. It's really a joy to speak to you, and I really want to thank all the listeners, because I know that out there, there are people that have bought our music, listened to my songs, and thanks to all of you, I've been able to make a life in music, which is, to me, my happiest place.
After two banks collapsed in 3 days, President Biden sought to reassure the nation. His administration, he said, is on it.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you, we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, was the 16th largest bank in the U.S. A lot of startup tech companies had money there, and not just ones in Silicon Valley. Tech firms across the globe banked with SVB, including many in the United Kingdom. Over the weekend, 140 tech companies based in Britain sent a letter to the government there saying that the insolvency of SVB posed an existential threat for them. So the Bank of England stepped in and helped steer the sale of SVB's British subsidiary to the banking giant HSBC. The cost of that sale, £1. Eddie Duzlak is the founder of an investment firm called Virtuant that specializes in bank stocks and joins us from Durham, North Carolina. It was a pretty scary weekend, Eddie, starting on Friday for tech companies everywhere. In the UK, how much money was tied up with Silicon Valley Bank and at risk? Do we know?
You're talking to the tune of billions of dollars in capital that was tied up and potentially at risk, given that FDIC insurance wouldn't have covered the UK subsidiary.
So is the problem more or less resolved right now? I mean, how well can these tech companies actually sleep well at night?
Well, it should be resolved. I mean, at least within the U.S., there was an announcement over the weekend that uninsured depositors would be made whole. Those funds would be paid starting today. And so that should create calm, especially given, you know, Biden announcing that they will essentially do whatever it takes to calm the panic. There are a number of banks that are facing deposit runs, and they have what are called securities portfolios that are things like treasuries, mortgage-backed securities that were bought prior to interest rates rising as fast as they have. And those are mark-to-market losses right now. But when deposits flee, they have to sell those assets. And as they sell those assets, those unrealized losses become realized losses, and they need to raise money as a result.
Yeah, so just picking up on one thing you said there, the policy of raising interest rates, that's come from the U.S. Fed and finance ministries and central banks across the globe. That has something to do with all this?
It 100% did. It started with actually COVID. COVID, they announced the stimulus measures. The stimulus measures caused deposit growth at banks to skyrocket. I mean, these deposits tend to be a pretty stable metric if you look at it over time. The line of deposits just is, you know, not that exciting. When COVID hit, you had the fastest growth rate in the 40 years of data that we have available through the FDIC. Banks couldn't loan that money fast enough. What they ended up doing with that money was they bought things like treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities. They bought these to earn a yield while they had these deposits. The challenge is that then when the Fed raised interest rates due to inflation, and those securities lost value, but it caused these what are called unrealized losses on those securities portfolios. And then as soon as you have something like a bank run where you have all of your liabilities getting pulled at once, you have to pay out those liabilities. That's causing unrealized losses to be realized. So interest rates are kind of like the kind of the driving force behind all of this, in a way.
So, as I said, the British bank HSBC bought the subsidiary of SVB for £1, a great deal, were it not for all the debt they're now taking on. Why did HSBC do it?
SVB had a great business. I mean, they have some of the best, you know, clients out there, and it was one of the most profitable banks globally for the better part of a decade.
Eddie, how big a risk is there that this contagion could be global?
You know, in theory, it should not be. But there are knock-on effects we're not privy to at the moment. There are ways that this could turn into a global issue. It shouldn't be, because depositors are guaranteed now in the U.S., more or less by the U.S. government. But, you know, if you have depositors worried about losing money now at other banks around the world, I mean, theoretically, this could become a concern. I think in some sense, it kind of dampens risk appetite, and global financial markets kind of trade more or less based on a risk appetite. And this has kind of gotten people a little nervous. And so I think the larger issue is probably not that there's going to be bank runs all over the world, but more that maybe people are kind of waking up to, well, if you raise interest rates at such a fast rate, things may break.
Eddie Duzlak is the founder of the investment firm Virtuant that specializes in bank stocks. He joined us from Durham, North Carolina. Eddie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Really grateful.
By the time the Academy Awards were done last night, pretty much everyone understood what Natu is.
Not salsa, not flamenco, my brother. Do you know Natu?
What is Natu?
A clip there from the blockbuster RRR, which stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt. It's one of the most expensive and successful films ever made in India. It comes out of Tollywood, that's South India's Telugu language movie industry, the smaller but apparently no less impactful cousin of Bollywood in Mumbai. As the song's composer M.M. Keeravani explained backstage last night at the Oscars, the song is a pure style unique to South India.
Natu Natu is the pure original cultural genre of Indian music, particularly South Indian music, which has lots of percussions and the rustic texture of the music.
RRR, the film the song is from, is billed as an anti-colonial thriller, with the two main characters drawn from the history of Indian freedom fighters battling British occupation in the 1920s. There's been a trend in Indian cinema in recent years that RRR is part of, films that push a national pride agenda, which in Tali and Bollywood these days translates for some as a Hindu nationalist agenda. There's certainly a lot of pride around the Oscar win, but some critics have taken note of the political tone of the moment, especially when the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, offered his over-the-top congratulations on Twitter after the big win. Exceptional, he wrote. The popularity of Natu Natu is global, he continued. It will be a song that will be remembered for years to come. India is elated and proud. Dance Till You Drop, Natu Natu there. This year's Oscar for Best Song brings this Monday edition of The World to a close. We come to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here again tomorrow.